Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Brad Udall joins us today. He's in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to the show, Brad. I wanted to start with a very quick question. How dry is it in the western United States right now?
It's really dry. So I'm looking at an image of the U.S. drought monitor right now, and the entire Southwest is in some stage of drought, from abnormally dry to exceptionally dry. And about a third of it is exceptionally dry. A third of it is an extreme drought, and the remainder is in these other categories. It's bad.
I'm seeing here that something like more than, taken together, it's more than 70% of the West.
Yeah, I would say looking at the map, it might even be more than that. And it's really centered over the states in which I mostly work, the Colorado River Basin.
Okay. So describe to me, I mean, so you mentioned the Colorado, the mighty carver of canyons, right? The lifeblood of much of the West and the Southwest. What's the river level at?
So since the year 2000, the flow is down almost 20% based on the 20th century average. We have lost in our two largest reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell. They've gone from roughly 100% full in the year 2000 down to about 40% full right now. And much of this decline is now being attributed to climate change.
Down 60% in those two reservoirs?
Yep. Two largest reservoirs in the United States.
Wow. Okay. So for anyone who, say, stood on the crest of the Hoover Dam and looked back at how huge Lake Mead is, I mean, it's almost unimaginable to think that it's down 60% from what it was years ago. So, but Brad, I mean, this sounds very, very serious. It does not sound like a normal drought. What is the West experiencing, or the Southwest in particular, experiencing right now?
So scientists have started to use a new term for what's going on in the American Southwest, and the term's a mouthful, aridification. And what we're really talking about here is a long-term warming and drying of the American West. And it's somewhat related to desertification, but that would take maybe centuries or 100 years to happen. But it's certainly, we're on our way to this very different landscape in the American West because of these temperatures that are well over 2 Fahrenheit warmer than they were, say, 50 years ago.
Okay. And you have lived your life in this part of the country. Your family goes back a long ways. Have you ever seen it like this persistently dry?
No. It's shocking. You know, you mentioned Hoover Dam and standing on top of it. If you go stand there right now and look, you'll see a white band around the reservoir that's 150 feet tall. And that white band represents the loss in that particular reservoir of 15 million acre feet, which is a whole year's worth of flow. It's 150 feet high, this white band.
So that's the bathtub ring, right? The famous bathtub ring on the reservoir. It's 150. Okay, that is actually one of my favorite places in all of the United States. So my heart is absolutely breaking right now that this is happening. Do you think you talked about aridification of the West. Is this going to end ever, or is this a permanent new state?
No, it's a new state, unfortunately. And we may get some minor breaks as the century unfolds, you know, 5 or maybe even a decade of wet years. But the long-term trend here is warming and drying. And, you know, I mean, here's some numbers in Phoenix last year. Record set of days over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. They had 110 days. That's half again, as many as happened 100 years ago. Tucson had 4 inches of rain, the lowest they've ever recorded. The Colorado River had 100% of snowpack above Lake Powell on April 1. We ended up with 50% of normal runoff out of that 100% of snowpack.
What? Okay. The numbers are actually bending my brain in a way that's hard for me to keep up here. So why half the runoff off 100% snowpack?
Yep. Why? Because it's actually pretty simple. So any given day is warmer than it was historically. And we now have longer growing seasons. So both the spring and the fall are longer. And then finally, something that's really important, as it warms, the atmosphere wants to hold more moisture. So you have this greater atmospheric suck or sponge above our head that's trying to drain the earth, the soils and the reservoirs and our rivers of water. So all three of those conspire together to reduce the amount of precipitation that falls from the sky that actually ends up in our rivers.
Uh-huh. Okay. So I suppose I should finally get around to saying this is on point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You're listening to Brad Udall, senior water and climate research scientist at Colorado State University. He's in Boulder. And we're talking about not just a mega drought in the western United States, but the aridification, as Brad calls it, of an enormous swath of the country. So not just any dry spell, but a set of climactic conditions that could signal a permanent change for both humans and nature in the West. And we're going to really dig into what that means over the course of this hour, because we've seen droughts before in the West, but this is something different. So, Brad, if you could just hang on with me for a minute. We wanted to hear from, you know, people who live and work and rely on the land in this part of the country. So this is husband and wife ranching team Kenyon Fields and Mary Conover. They own Mountain Island Ranch.
Let's see, our headquarters is at around 6,000 feet, and it's mostly pinyon and juniper and sagebrush. And then we go up to 10,000 feet, which is an aspen forest, and all the way to the Colorado River, which is basically desert.
The ranch has been in Mary's family for 50 years, and historically they've grown organic hay and raised cattle. And their ranch is one of the largest in the area, 122,000 acres on the Uncompahgre Plateau between Moab, Utah, and Grand Junction, Colorado.
The middle country, once you leave the aspen forest and you go downhill towards the Colorado River, looks like the photographs of, you know, Arches National Park and those kind of places. We have 500-foot sandstone walls that rise up from the valley floor.
They say it's been impossible not to notice how the climate is changing, and soon they'll be forced to make some tough decisions. But Mary also remembers when things were different.
Well, in the old days, when I first was on the ranch, you know, 45 years ago or however long it was, we used to have a system of ditches, which I look back on now as just, it astounds me that we were able to irrigate as much as we did. And so now what we're seeing is not only drought and the culmination of years and years of drought, but with climate change, there's unreliability in terms of weather patterns. We used to receive monsoons quite regularly in the summer times. We haven't had those in, I'd say, well over 5 or 6 years. And in the fall, we tend to move our cattle down from the high country to the mid-level country where we have one hay farm. And they can no longer be there in the fall because there's no water in the creek. It's actually called the Little Dolores River, which is a tributary to the Colorado. And it was historically a year-round creek. And now it's an ephemeral creek. It has been drying up these last few years by the middle of June. So basically our summers are all about water management and moving water. As of this winter, we decided to destock the ranch because it's become too problematic.
We can't guarantee that we can keep animals alive 365 days a year and instead have to just take some third-party cattle on when we can and get them off when we don't have the resources. In order to adapt to a changing climate and the chaos of the irregularity of the climate, you have to be extremely flexible. And a traditional cow-calf operation is not a flexible operation.
I am considering selling outlying pieces that are not absolutely critical to the operational flow of the ranch. And I'm watching now in the area where we live, several other ranches are selling off. I mean, some of them are historic ranches are splitting their ranches up.
You know, Mary's taken on the ranch from her mother and is passing it on to her son, who's grown up working on the ranch and loving the ranch and wants to have it, you know, continue in the family. But a lot of ranches don't have a margin to allow them to hold on much longer unless something changes quick. I think the next 5 years will determine whether or not ranches like ours make it or have to become something else or get broken up or sold off. And, you know, how policymakers respond right now is going to make all the difference.
That was Kenyon Fields and Mary Conover of Mountain Island Ranch, 122,000 acres on the Colorado-Utah line. Brad Udall, they're ranchers, Kenyon and Mary, but more broadly, if we look at ag in the West, I mean, it uses what, 70% of the water in the West. How much is this mega drought, this aridification, having an impact on land use and agriculture there?
It's an enormous impact. And let me just say, listening to that story is heartbreaking. I have heard anecdotal stories from my extension colleagues at the university that these kind of problems were underway. But to actually listen to these voices, it's heart-wrenching.
Yeah. And I mean, they're talking about 5 years. That's no time at all. A five-year window about whether they're going to go under as a business or not, and their fellow ranchers as well. It seems like the emergency is not just coming, but it's upon the West.
Yeah, and that's increasingly a story of climate change over the last few years, right? For many years, we've talked about this as being in the future, and it's not. It's here right now. We've got to deal with it on all levels.
Well, Brad Udall, stand by, because we are going to talk about that the rest of this hour, about urban water use, about agricultural water use in the West, and really what needs to be done to deal with the aridification of nearly half the country. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are coming to terms with the fact that much of the Western United States is experiencing a mega drought. In fact, it's not just a temporary situation. Our guest today, Brad Udall, says it's the aridification of the West, and particularly the Southwest of the United States. Brad Udall is senior water and climate research scientist at Colorado State University and the Colorado Water Center. He hails from the Udall family, of course, and we'll talk a lot more about that, a very historic family in the American West. But we're going to talk about urban water use in a second here. But Brad, I wanted to just stick with ag here for a minute, because it is a huge portion of the water use in the West, at least 70%, as I mentioned earlier. And we could spend 10 hours talking about the water agreements and the long history of water sharing in the West. But can you tell me a little bit more? Like, are there the agriculture business and industry and farmers must be trying to figure out new ways of doing what they do to deal with a persistently drier climate. What are they thinking about? What are they talking about?
So first off, let me just say that ag in the Colorado River Basin is really diverse, right? Mm-hmm. You have ranchers at the highest elevations that do grow a lot of hay and have a super short growing season. And then in the lower basin, like down around the Mexico border, you can grow year-round crops. And those people can grow just about anything, including much of the nation's winter produce. So it's a really varied system. I will tell you that ag community is very concerned about this, and they're specifically concerned because in some places, municipalities have their eye on this water, right? If it gets really dry, where the municipality is going to go to get water, they're going to go to ag, which uses 70%.
So places like what, Phoenix, Tucson? I mean, Arizona is kind of a special case here, right?
Yeah, Arizona is very much a special case due to, as you mentioned, this really complicated set of laws. And yes, both Phoenix and Tucson, Tucson has no surface water. Phoenix is 50% dependent on Colorado River water, despite being roughly 200 miles and a couple thousand vertical feet away from the river.
Well, I guess in the special case, maybe I should just directly refer to the fact that like there's Arizona as a state has a different position in the eyes of the federal government regarding water use or their access to water. Do I have that right?
You do indeed. And it dates back to a 1968 law that some of my forebears that you mentioned were involved with. A huge entity, a huge canal called the Central Arizona Project was authorized by the federal government in 1968. It's a $4 billion, 336-mile-long canal that moves 1.6 million acre-feet. 10% of the flow of the river actually ends up in Central Arizona via this canal. And in order to get this passed by Congress, Arizona agreed to be the first one to take shortages if there ever wasn't enough water in the river. And that agreement is now haunting us.
And your forebears being your father, right? Former Congressman Mo Udall and your uncle, Stuart Udall, right? Who was Secretary of the Interior under Kennedy and Johnson.
Yep, you're right there.
Well, we'll talk more about them a little bit later in the show. But so also, like, okay, so I really want us to explore just for a second here about looking for solutions, right? Because this is happening in the West. People are having to adapt. And I'll admit, sometimes when I think of ag in the West, I forget your really important point that it's really diverse depending on what state and region you're talking about. And I have this like old school impression in my mind of just shunting water away from rivers and flooding fields and growing green crops where they're not supposed to grow with relying on natural rainfall or groundwater. But certainly, I mean, practices must be modernizing and changing with the new water realities for ag, Brad. Is that happening?
Yeah, it is happening. I mean, the farmers around Yuma, Arizona, love to showcase what they've done. And, you know, they laser level fields so that when you flood irrigate, the water gets really efficiently to where it needs to go. And they have modernized infrastructure. They use sprinklers when it's appropriate. So people are slowly getting with the program. I will tell you, in large parts of the West, ag needs funds. It needs infrastructure. Much of this stuff's 100 years old, and they're trying to work. You know, this is not a highly profitable business in many cases, and they're struggling to make ends meet. I think it's important we not victimize, make ag the culprit that, of all this problem. They use a lot of water, yes, but everywhere in the world where you have these arid areas, which can be really productive because they've got great sunlight, ag uses lots of water. That's just the way it works.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit later about how water being one of the essential needs for life is something that hopefully can be dealt with outside of our typical political divides. But I want to just actually dive into the science for one more second with you, Brad, because I just kind of love how science understands these big climactic changes. How do you know that this is like one of the biggest mega droughts in 1,000 years? How do we know that?
And Meghna, I want to acknowledge first to the listeners here that you have an engineering background. Civil and environmental engineer, right? So you get this stuff.
You read my bio. Okay, yes.
I did indeed, and it jumped out at me. But to your question, how do we know? So since 2016, there have been 5 really important peer-reviewed scientific studies on the Colorado River. One of them expressly said for a given amount of precipitation, we're actually getting less runoff. And the reason we're getting less runoff is because of these higher temperatures and more evaporation. I've been involved in 2 studies that have pinned the human component of this 20% decline in river flow at half. So we've lost 10% of the river flow because of these higher temperatures in two different peer-reviewed studies. There's another study that actually says for every degree Celsius or roughly 2 degrees Fahrenheit warming, the river loses approximately 10% of flow. And there's yet one other study out there that talks about this emerging mega drought, that this, as measured by soil moisture, is the second driest period in the last 1,200 years.
As measured by soil moisture?
Yep.
And you're getting that from what? From tree? Is that the tree ring data?
Well, no, this gets into pretty complicated science, and I'm not quite sure I could explain it in the time we have.
Okay. I just wanted to give, I'll use this as an opportunity to give the bristlecone pines a shout out because I love those trees. I think they're amazing. The oldest individual living organisms anywhere, and at least some of this data is coming from tree ring data from the bristlecones. Is that right?
Some of it, yeah. Okay. You know, we now can reconstruct stream flows using tree rings back 1,200 years, too. And that gives us an idea just how serious the drought is.
Okay. So, Brad, hang on here for just a second, because as much as I want to talk about tree ring data, which I would do an hour on maybe sometime in the future, we do need to focus. We talked about ag a little bit. We need to focus on urban water use because populations are growing in the West. So Colby Pellegrino joins us now from Las Vegas, Nevada. Colby is Deputy General Manager of Resources for the Las Vegas Valley Water District and the Southern Nevada Water Authority. We were talking about Lake Mead just a couple of minutes ago. So Colby, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Meghna.
And I understand you're born and bred in Las Vegas.
I am.
How much has the city grown in your lifetime?
When I was born, there was about 300,000 people living in the Las Vegas Valley, and today there's over 2.3 million. So just a little bit.
Just a little bit. And is the city showing any sign of sort of cooling off that growth?
Well, we certainly see a much lower growth rate now than we did in some of our peak years. But we anticipate that the city is going to continue to grow for the foreseeable future.
So water needs are going to continue to rise then, it's fair to say.
Well, we've actually been successful at sort of decoupling water use from growth. Obviously, that won't be sustainable forever. But as we look back at the way we developed in the past and sort of correct that through water conservation, we actually use significantly less water today than we did 20 years ago.
Oh, that's terrific. So I want to talk to you in a second about how you've done that, how you've achieved that. But, you know, you heard Brad earlier talk about the bathtub ring at Lake Mead being 150 feet deep. I mean, that's really stunning to me. Like, what is the situation of water availability for Vegas? And you must stand at that very point we were talking about quite often and just like look across the water and wonder where it's all going.
You know, we certainly see it, I think, quite a bit more often than our other partners on the river because it's right in our backyard. But the decline in Lake Mead is certainly something that we keep our eye on. And we spend a lot of time examining climate change and future projections. That lake is 90% of the supply for our community. So the health of that lake, in terms of the volume of water in it, as well as the water quality, is something we care about quite a bit.
90% of the water for the Las Vegas area. I mean, so it's critical, to say the least. What are those climate change projections? What are they telling you?
The climate change projections that we see tell us a story that's not any different than what we've been hearing from Brad. The West is going to get hotter, it's going to get drier, and for a river that was originally allocated 16.5 million acre feet of use, we expect that long-term flows around mid-century will really be somewhere near 11 million acre feet. So what it's telling us is we need to all find a way to use less water and not rely upon the water that was allocated to us 100 years ago.
Uh-huh. Okay. So the allocations then are decoupling from reality of what's available, right? So that, I mean, that's kind of the central part of the story here. But you had talked earlier about how, I mean, speaking of decoupling, that at least for now, Las Vegas has decoupled population growth from actual water use. Tell me more about what that means and how you've achieved that.
So starting in 2000, kind of coincident with the beginning of this drought, the Las Vegas Valley began implementing really aggressive water conservation practices. We're a pretty unique community in that we sit so close to the Colorado River and we're fairly new. So most of our homes are on centralized sewer. We treat and return all of that water back to Lake Mead. So in doing water conservation, the only water that we're really losing or permanently using, what we call a consumptive use, is water that's used outside. It's anything that's not hitting the drain. So the thing that we really went after was starting to make the desert look like a desert. When people moved to Las Vegas from elsewhere, they brought their Kentucky bluegrass and their tall fescue with them. And that really doesn't have a place in most places in the desert. We do need it for recreation, for schools, for parks, but there's a lot of places in this community where we really didn't need that much turf. So the biggest thing we've done is take on outdoor uses. And we did that through sort of a multifaceted approach, education, outreach, but we limited the ability to install new turf. If you're outside of a residential setting, a school or a park, you're no longer allowed to use grass at all. And then within the residential sector, no grass in the front yard, only 50% of the grass in the backyard. Everyone's on a seasonal watering schedule because your grass doesn't need as much water in the winter as it does in the summer when it's 120 degrees here. So we've really gotten to the community this message that we need to treat our outdoor spaces like they're a desert and come up with desert-friendly landscaping.
After all, I mean, it is the desert, right? Brad Udall, let me turn back to you here for a second, because Colby's describing a system in Las Vegas where, as she said, it's actually the water's kind of mostly operating in a closed loop, except for some of those outdoor uses that she was talking about. So then they curb the outdoor use as much as possible. But is she also mentioned that it's kind of unique to Las Vegas due to where they're sitting relevant to where the water's coming from. So is Vegas's water management approach going to work for other southwestern cities?
Yeah, to some degree it has. And I would tell you that Las Vegas has been a leader and other cities have copied some of their programs, like their famous and somewhat odd, funnily named Cash for Grass program, where they pay people to rip out grass. Other people have now copied throughout the West. So they are unique. And they have taken this unbelievably seriously, including, I think Colby can correct me if I'm wrong, but spending $1.5 billion to make sure that their intake into Lake Mead is at the very bottom. They've had really far-reaching ideas and have pursued them. And other cities in the West, too, have also decoupled this growth from water use. And can this go on forever? I don't know. But it's promising.
Mm. So, Colby, you did mention earlier that the reality of what's available doesn't match what the allocations are for Nevada. And I'm thinking about that along with this sort of sound, as Brad is describing, a long-term new reality regarding even just focusing on Lake Mead, like what's going to be in the reservoir. So I wonder, as Vegas continues to grow, how long do you think the current sort of practices that you've been describing are going to be adequate? Or will you need to really think about new solutions for long-term sustainability?
That's a great question. So we take a 50-year water resource plan to our board of directors every single year. And we anticipate that there's population growth for that entire 50-year period. And we find that with the resources we have today and conservation, we can remain a sustainable community, even with lower flows on the Colorado River, even with shortages higher than the ones we take today, that we still have water to supply our community. But that doesn't mean that that's just based upon the existing programs that we have today. We're constantly looking at the community and water use and new things that we can bring online to continue conserving water. One of our new big arenas that we're really just starting to tiptoe into is evaporative cooling. Almost every office park and certainly large buildings, evaporative cooling is one of the cheapest options for upfront installation, but it has a very high water use associated with it. And that's water that's evaporating into the air and being used to cool buildings year round. So looking at that and looking at what other technology exists where we don't have, again, that consumptive use of water, whether that's just air cooled systems or geothermal, there's lots of ways that we continue to look for to save water.
Well, Colby Pellegrino is Deputy General Manager of Resources for the Las Vegas Valley Water District and the Southern Nevada Water Authority, speaking to us from Las Vegas. Thank you so much for joining us, Colby.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this hour we are talking about the mega drought going on in the American West, particularly the Southwest. And it's more than just a drought. It is the aridification, the ongoing aridification of the West. Brad Udall joins us today. He's senior water and climate research scientist at Colorado State University, and the Colorado Water Center joins us from Boulder, Colorado. And we wanted to actually step back in history a little bit, because obviously the issues of water in the West go way, way back. John Ross is author of the book The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. Now, Powell was a 19th century scientist and explorer who had an uncanny understanding for how water works in the West. And Ross told us about a moment in 1893 when Powell was in Los Angeles giving a keynote speech at the Second International Irrigation Conference.
So you imagine this grizzled guy has one arm that he lost during the Civil War and a big beard, and he gets up and everybody knows who he is. The hall quiets down. They're all waiting for him to say, yeah, science is the way, you know, everything's going to happen. And he says the opposite. I'm going to read you his words. When all the rivers are used, when all the creeks and the ravines, when all of the brooks, when all of the springs are used, when all of the reservoirs along the streams are used, when all the canyon waters are taken up, when all of the artesian waters are taken up, when all the wells are sunk or dug that can be dug, there is still not sufficient water to irrigate all of this arid region. I tell you, gentlemen, you are piling up a heritage of conflict and litigation over water rights, for there is not sufficient water to supply these arid lands.
That was what Powell said in 1893. And if there has ever been a prediction that's come true, it is that. But in 1893, the audience actually booed Powell. So thank you to John Ross, author of the book The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West, for that historical reminder there. Brad Udall, Powell's an interesting figure here. We don't have a ton of time to talk about him, but didn't he have a completely different way, a different idea of how sort of water should be governed in the West that we did not adopt?
Yeah, his idea was that we should have boundaries, political boundaries that represented watersheds. And it would have been great to implement them because many of the arguments nowadays around water exist because of these square lines we've drawn over these very complicated watersheds.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about what John Ross read us there is when he says that they're all waiting for Powell, again, in 1893, to say science is the way. I feel like that has been the approach to water management in the United States for more than a century, right? I mean, as much as I love Lake Mead and the Hoover Dam, we have been sort of enamored with this idea that we can engineer our way out of a problem, out of this problem. And now we have a situation where that kind of thinking and therefore policymaking has not caught up with the environmental and climactic realities of the West, right? So should our focus be more on adopting new policies for this reality? Or, you know, we've been talking a lot about technology and not enough about how we make decisions around water use.
Yeah, so there's a set of agreements that are going to expire at the end of 2026, and they were put in place in the early 2000s. Right now, we're beginning to talk about what those new agreements look like. And I would completely agree. We're not going to engineer our way out of this. And as Colby said, we're going to have to go from 16.5 million acre feet down to 11 million acre feet. That means cutting out a third of existing uses. And what policies we design to deal with that will be critical here, because you want to do right by everybody to the extent you can. And you got to consider economics, you got to consider the environment, you got to consider social and cultural values. But it's going to be a painful process to get to a solution that does the least harm and the most good.
Yeah. You know, I think this isn't unique to water in the West, but I think we are as a nation seeing the effects of relying on policies that were set a half century or a century ago and not modernizing them for what our current reality is. Because, you know, Colby would also mention, she mentioned to us as we were preparing for this show, the idea that in farming and ranching in the West, we've often seen water policy be basically use it or lose it for farmers and ranchers, mm-hmm. right? So if they don't use what's allocated to them, they'll lose those water rights. So sometimes they may have been overusing, but that's just because they had to preserve the right to the water. Whereas it seems like we could benefit now from a much more dynamic system of water rights that really match more closely with what the needs are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think most people would scratch their heads at some of the oddities of Western water law. And I've often said that we have the potential to lose the public in the way that some of this gets implemented. So, for example, the idea out of the 1968 law that gave Arizona the right and funds to build that project, that it would be completely shorted before, say, California had one drop of shortage. I mean, that might have worked politically in 1968. It absolutely cannot work in a 2021 when Phoenix is 50% dependent on that water.
And so what do we do then? I mean, right? Like, that's the big question that we could ask for till we're blue in the face. What do we do?
Well, what you do, Magna, is you talk. You talk and you talk and you talk. And you use some money in some cases, and you use some technology occasionally, and you come up with a solution that works for people. And, you know, I will argue, despite all the pessimism and sort of harum scarum we got going here over the serious nature of this, when you listen to Colby, you realize there's unbelievable competence in our water managers. And what she projects is true of everybody in this basin. And that's where I actually have optimism that we will find a solution to this, as painful as it will be to get there.
Mm. But what about the folks who would say, look, there shouldn't even be that many people in the desert to begin with, right? Because of human hubris and the belief in engineering above all, much as I love engineering, but that we created this problem by creating a situation where humans should be where humans can be where they're not, and that ultimately, now perhaps due to climate change, there is just simply going to be a limit to how much growth we can have in major parts of the West and Southwest. And maybe folks are just going to have to pick up and move somewhere else. What do you think?
You know, I think, what do I think? You know, Colby said they're projecting more people to come. And I think that's a sensible and sane thing to do. I think there may come a time when people in parts of the American Southwest decide that they don't want to live there. And you know, we're not going to pass legislation or tell people they can't live there. This will just happen organically. And it's always been the case that Tucson and Phoenix and Las Vegas have been, frankly, too hot to really live in, at least as far as I'm concerned, in the summertime. Other people may have different mileage there. But as it gets warmer and as you get pinned more and more inside, because of climate change, it may very well be that industries and folks go, you know, maybe we should find some other place to live. And that'll happen organically. I mean, people are already talking about better places to live in a climate changed world, right?
Mm-hmm. But I also sense that you want to push back a little on sort of a broader critique that maybe the whole region is unsustainable.
You know, from a renewable energy perspective, the Southwest has got unbelievable solar resources, right? I mean, if you want to power air conditioning with renewable energy, you got lots in the American Southwest. And there have been studies in Tucson, for example, about trying to live on the rainwater that they actually get without importing water. And there are some people at the University of Arizona think that this is possible. I don't know. I just this sort of centralized idea that you tell people they can't do something seems to always fail, right? And so, yeah, there are certainly sustainable aspects of the American Southwest and unsustainable aspects as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to take a minute or two, Brad, to just talk a little bit more with you about your family's long history in the region, because I'm sure many listeners are shouting at their radios right now saying, why haven't you expressly mentioned that Brad Udall's brother is former Senator Mark Udall from Colorado, another cousin is a senator from New Mexico, Tom Udall. We mentioned your uncle Stuart Udall, who was Interior Secretary in the 60s under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And of course, your father, Mo Udall, Congressman from Arizona for decades here. So, I mean, your family actually is directly tied into some of the big policy decisions around water in the West. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, it's an interesting heritage to have, right? And I kind of laugh in that my father and my uncle created some of these problems that I now work on, right? It feels like a perpetual employment machine. You know, they did their best and worked with the knowledge and skills that they had at the time. We've learned a whole lot more. Certainly, they weren't all of it, right? I mean, there were a lot of other people working on water issues in Arizona and California at the time. In some ways, the most fun person in my background is my great-great-grandfather, this guy John D. Lee, who founded Lee's Ferry. Lee's Ferry now is the all-important dividing line between the upper basin and the lower basin as set out in the 1922 Colorado River Compact. And we earlier mentioned John Wesley Powell. He took two trips to the Grand Canyon, was the first guy to actually go through the Grand Canyon by boat. And one of those trips, he actually visited and went right through Lee's Ferry and, as I understand it, interacted with my forebearer there, John D. Lee.
Hmm. So, Brad, you talked about water being a perpetual employment machine for your family, but the line of continuity is interesting, right? Because what was it, your father and your uncle, they wanted to build some more dams on the Grand Canyon. Do I have that right? I don't want to get my history wrong here.
Yeah. No, you're airing family dirty laundry there. So flashback to the 1960s when they were trying to figure out how to build the Central Arizona Project and how to fund it. And one of the funding ideas at the time was to build what they called cash register dams in the bottom of the Grand Canyon with hydroelectric power as an output and hence dollars. And ultimately, people like the Sierra Club fought back vociferously, if you will, with full-page ads in the New York Times. And And both my uncle and my father realized the error of their ways. At one point in time, I think my father said he may not have seen the light, but he certainly felt the heat. And they backed off this idea of dams in the Grand Canyon, which were a horrible idea. Both later did Grand Canyon river trips and grew to understand the unbelievable beauty that exists in the Grand Canyon, this natural world, wonder of the world. And what came out of that actually was this thing called the Navajo Generating Station, this coal-fired power plant near Page, Arizona, that recently just shut down because of all the problems that coal now has in this world, both carbon and economic. But they decided to fund it with this coal-fired power plant that would then generate revenues. And both Mo and Stuart later became well-known for their environmental actions. And would argue made up for their earlier sins.
Well, we've got a minute to go in this conversation. And Brad, the reason why I wanted to mention that is because, I mean, dams have always been controversial, but they were also a potential solution for their time.
Yeah.
Now we're in 2021 and the West desperately needs new solutions for this time, right? And you had underscored earlier that, like, this is climate change driven change. It's going to be with us forever, right? The years are just going to get hotter is what you're saying, that the West is experiencing its cooler years now going forward. So in the last minute that we have here, just how much is this going to define everyday life in the Western United States?
So, yeah, you hit on it, right? As warm as these recent years have been, it's better to think of them as the coolest in the next 100 years. This warmth and dryness, this aridification will define the American West. And what we really need to do is both get in place water policies that, again, do the least harm and the most good.
Yeah.
And at the same time, do something we haven't much talked about here, which is really get at being net zero with our carbon emissions as soon as we possibly can, because this can get worse. It will get worse. How worse is in our control, and we need to stop it.
Well, Brad, I think your sigh said everything there, but I am inspired by your push to do something about this. So Brad Udall, Senior Water and Climate Research Scientist at Colorado State University and the Colorado Water Center, thank you so much for being with us today.
Magna, thank you. My pleasure.
Well, we're going to end today's hour about the mega drought and aridification of the West with a little more from Kenyon Fields, ranch owner on the Colorado-Utah line. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
We're standing alongside the Little Dolores River, which is really more of a creek, but these days is more of an ephemeral stream that's been drying up for the first time in anyone's memory in early June and not flowing again until, like, this year it was November. And even once it started flowing, it didn't make it all the way through the property until the very end of February. It was so busy filling all the dry recesses of the rocks underneath the stream bed because the snowpack that feeds it isn't coming anymore, and the summer monsoon rains that feed it aren't happening anymore. This is a sound we're used to hearing year-round, but these days, this river only flows for a few months a year.